Great, so we're here at the festival on South Bank in the Queen Elizabeth Hall foyer, and we're recording for Resonance FM, live on the stage in the foyer of Queen Elizabeth Hall. And it's the third and final day of festival. It's been a really exciting 3 days. We've seen so many things that we didn't think were humanly possible in the centre of London. My name's Farry Bradley, I'm from Resonance FM, and I'm joined now by Mark Carnell from Grant Museum of Technology at UCL, and Professor J. Scott Turner, Professor of Biology at Freeform Engineering. Is that your part of?
That's the company. I'm at State University of New York in Syracuse.
Oh, that's right. So you're a Professor of Biology at State University.
That's right.
But at the moment, you're not a Professor of Biology. You're actually an entertainer outside the Termite Pavilion. I saw you with children dancing. Did you see it, Mark?
Yeah, I've seen it throughout the weekend.
So there's been children dancing, and there's an amazing structure. Can you tell us a bit about the structure, please?
Sure. This is a part of a collaborative effort that's centered around the company Freeform Engineering. I'm a research partner with Dr. Rupert Soar, who is formerly of Loughborough University. And we've been doing a collaborative research project on termite mounds and how they work. And part of the outcome of this is some very interesting findings on structure of termite mounds. And the exhibit that you speak about is a large 6-meter by 6-meter cube that represents a small part of the inside of a termite mound.
Right, and you can see it says it's at the Purcell Room at the Queen Elizabeth Hall, 4 p.m. There's termite technology talk. Is that you as well?
That was us yesterday. We gave a very nice. We gave a series of talks. There were several of us. There was me. There was Dr. Soar. There was Patrick Bellew, Christopher Taggett, and Chris Hines, I believe his name is, who was responsible for putting together the materials that made this structure possible.
But well, it is amazing structure. It looks like a huge piece of honeycomb in kind of way, and it's very flowy. It's not at all what I associate with the termite mound. Now, Mark, do you know anything about termites? This is going to be really interesting.
I am the curator for the Grant Museum of Zoology, so we have animals from all over the animal kingdom, including termites.
You have live animals at UCL?
Mostly.
Aside from students?
Apart from students and pests, mostly dead animals at the university.
All right, so your stall consists of stuffed insects.
We're in a stall with some other societies, and we're the bug ID tent. So people can bring along bugs, photos of bugs, drawings, sketches, and our job is to try and identify them, as well as give some information about the animals that we might see in our gardens, in the country, or if you're away on holiday.
So there's a kind of bug detective stall.
There is bug detective. We had a couple of IDs brought in, and so far we've got 100% success record. So.
Oh, well, that's not fair. That's your full-time job. So where is the bug ID stall?
The bug ID stall is right on the river. So not only have we had festival goers coming through, we've also had people just wandering along to see our brightly coloured tent and just come by and have a look at what we've got.
It's got this kind of museum feel, you know, there's glass cases with giant stag beetles that someone's taken the trouble to do some taxidermy on, and it's quite scary, but I'm sure the kids love it.
Yeah, they do. We've got stuffed and preserved specimens, but we've also got some live specimens wriggling around. So the Royal Entomology Society is with us, and they've got beetles that you quite often find in our food, and probably that we all eat without knowing.
That's just lovely. Thank you. Well, they do say they're nutritious. Now, how much do you know about termites, Mark?
Not a great deal about termites. Not my area of speciality.
And would you say that termites were your speciality, Professor?
Well, I'm actually a physiologist, and I sort of stumbled into termites sideways. But the structures that they build proved to be such a fascinating problem that I abandoned my original research on bird embryos and decided to work full-time on termite nests and how they work. And in the process, I've learned a lot about termites.
Now, is it true? I heard this morning that there is a place in the world where they use termites as part of a ritual, where they eat the termite head, the grub, and then they throw away the rest of the body. And also, they use the termite as a torch by setting a light to it. Did you know that, Mark?
Yeah.
You did? Yeah. It's just me then. Did you know that, Professor?
Well, I've just learned something new myself. I know that African cultures will eat flying termites, but I had not heard of this ritual before.
Mm. But you knew about the torches.
Well, it makes sense because these flying termites are very rich in fat, and I imagine they would light up very nicely.
So you knew about this, Mark. Where did you learn?
I don't know. You pick up all kinds of interesting facts around the place, and that's been interesting. With festivals, we've had people come in with their own stories, with their own specimens, lots of observations. So I think everyone has a naturalist somewhere within them. So people have come in and they've been telling us about animals that they used to see when they were younger and don't see anymore. So we've had lots of comments on things like hedgehogs, moles and earwigs, and also lots of people were interested in stag beetles. So a lot of people don't realise that we have them in this country, and that they, because I think there's a mindset that we have very, very boring insects in this country. But
we have a lot of cement.
Well, we do have a lot of cement, but we do have some bright and beautiful insects, including stag beetles, and also we get some lovely hawk moths, which you know can get quite big.
Right, well, obviously I work at Resonance FM. It's right in the centre of the city. I don't get to see many insects. A termite is not something I'd expect to see in the UK. Would it be possible?
A while ago, there was a fear that we had a termite outbreak in the south of the country. So termites, where they do occur, cause huge amounts of damage very, very quickly. So we're very lucky in this part of the world in that we don't have them. We don't have the multi-million sort of pound damage that they can do, even though they are beautiful insects.
How are they beautiful? That's just what I was thinking when you were talking about them as if they were pests. Professor, perhaps you can tell us what's beautiful about termites.
Well, what's beautiful about them is what they do. They build these magnificent structures. They look quite unassuming from the outside. They look like there's these large mounds. But if you open them up, you find this incredible network of tunnels sculpted quite beautifully, and it's quite stunning to see what they've built inside. But once you've looked at them for a while, you start to get kind of personally attached to them, and it's quite fun to watch them walk around.
Personally attached.
I'm afraid so.
So you started naming your termites.
I haven't named it yet. There's there's more than a million of them in a colony, so I would quickly run out of names. But they are quite sweet once you get to know them.
There's nothing icky about termites, is there? They're not oozing all that fat.
Well, they are a bit icky, actually. If you pick up a queen, for example, she oozes liquid all over your hand. So there is that bit of creep factor. But once you get to know them, they're you get over that.
Now, why would you pick up a queen termite anyway?
To look at it.
I'm stunned by this news. Is there anything we can do to see termites apart from come down to Pestival in England?
Well, termites are becoming glamorous now, and so there's lots of documentaries coming out on them, and you can see pictures of them in National Geographic. There's some beautiful pictures that come from a Google search on the internet, and that's the best way to see them right now. Or you can come to Southern Africa and dig up a few termite mounds. It's a wonderful place to visit.
And use them as torches.
You could use them as torches, yeah. Another thing that the sculpture shows off brilliantly, so if you come down and see it, is these fantastic structures that they make, but with the emphasis that they don't take up electricity, they don't cause the kind of huge amount of environmental damage that perhaps our structures do. So in a way, they're very green, aside from the damage that they cause to human structures, but then that's a very sort of selfish viewpoint to say that they're destroying our habitats, which we have made on habitats that we've destroyed before. So,
exactly. So
maybe it's their
place?
Revenge.
Yes, where's our place in the web? And interestingly, we always forget that every animal has its place, every insect has its place in the web. Where would you say the termite's place was in the web? What purpose does it serve in relation to other animals and a whole sort of ongoing structure?
Well, they are a fantastic animal, and the structures that they create themselves, if you ever go to parts of the world where you see them, it's such a fantastic part of the scenery that we just don't have. So when we imagine the English countryside, what we're actually talking about is farmed land for the most part, so the fields you see when you're driving down the motorway, but to see these termites structures in a natural environment is something we really miss out on, something that's really good. I'm not entirely sure where termites' natural place is. It's very hard to say where any animal's natural place is now that we've had such a huge impact on where animals live, where they roam, as well as the animals that we no longer get anymore.
If I could just add to that, the termites in southern Africa, they form a very vital role in the functioning of ecosystems. Just like in the English countryside, as Darwin showed 150 years ago or so, earthworms build soil. They're major agents of soil building. And in the dry habitats of southern Africa, these termites perform the very same function. They're major agents of soil building, and they make for a very productive productive ecosystem down there.
Soil building.
They're soil builders.
What does that actually mean, soil buildings? Mud hut?
Well, in the case of earthworms, of course, they take in leaf litter and they mix it with soil and then they deposit this fertilized stuff. But in the case of termite mounds, they gather food material, they move soil up to the surface, and it washes out onto the soil surface, and it makes for a churning of soil in the very same way the earthworms do, and it makes for a very fertile ecosystem.
Okay, so we finally touched on the termites' place in the whole system. It's that they keep the soil fertile by churning it up like earthworms do. Okay, so that's very important in a place like Africa where the ground gets very dry, very hard, and can't be farmed. Wouldn't you agree, Mark?
Yeah, there's a lot of, when people come to festivals, lots of, oh, these things are horrible and icky, and then lots of the entomologists are very quick to point out that if it wasn't for these creatures, we'd be in a hell of a lot of trouble.
How would we be in trouble? Tell us what the end of termites would mean terminally for human beings.
Well, I'm not too sure about termites, but when we move all the sort of detritivores, so things that like to eat a lot of poo, then we'd be knee deep walking around in all the natural litter. Because
what about our Victorian waste systems? Surely they're taking all the poo.
Well, that's in the more urban environments, and that's on a scale that we can kind of appreciate. But if we lost these insects and other animals like earthworms, things would very quickly fall apart.
Okay, so that's very interesting. That's definitely a good point. We should just hold that for a second. Go back to Africa. Think about the times in Africa when there's been famine. Do you think that termites have done something to help the earth be farmable in Africa, Professor?
Yes, in fact, if you take termites away from these arid ecosystems where they live, you would accelerate the process of desertification, and the very same thing that happened in the Sahel in sub-Saharan Africa would happen over a very wide range of lands, and that would not be very good for anyone who lives there, and famine would be one of the consequences.
So in terms of the landscape, they're vital?
Absolutely.
Okay, and then as we know, the landscape is host to all the other living animals and creatures that we need and love. But there's another aspect to this, which is that termites are also food for many of the animals that we know. So what animals do we know that eat termites?
Well, if you come down to Pestival, you can see a lot of taxidermy and prepared specimens. So we've got things like pangolins. Which can eat termites. There's a whole host of animals that live almost exclusively off of ants and termites, and we call them formiciferous animals.
Formiciferous?
Yes. So that where
that sounds like something a teacher might tell the class to do. Formiciferous class. one now.
It's one of those terms we've been getting people to guess what it means by having a look at the animals that we've got today. And it means if a large part of your diet is made up from ants or termites, then you are technically formiciferous.
Okay, what animals do we know that eat them?
Well, we have, if we include ants as well as termites, we have things like anteaters, obviously. And we also have things like aardwolves.
Aardwolves?
Aardwolves, yeah.
What's an aardwolf?
Aardwolf is a type of specialized termite specialist. It's related to the aardvark, and it's called an aardwolf because it has pointy ears and looks a little bit like a wolf, a little bit like a hyena.
No hair,
actually.
Though.
It does have hair. Yeah, it's quite a beautiful animal.
Yeah,
in fact.
It's kind of a cross between a hyena and a fox, and they've lost all their teeth. They don't have the big flat molars that we have and that carnivores have, which they're a part of, and they have these very short peg-like teeth, ideal for crunching up insects and also for digging around in termite nests.
Okay, so we've got aardvarks, aardwolves, which we've never heard of. And what else eats the termites?
Well, those are the main termite eaters normally, but once or twice a year down in southern Africa, you get a flight of fertile termites. This is the only stage in the life cycle of some termites where they have wings and can fly. And these are quite large, fatty insects. That's why they burn well, apparently, as I've just learned. And because they have a lot of fat, they're a real prized source when they come out. And so you get basically this feeding frenzy amongst all kinds of animals. There are specialized birds that go after them, lots of mongoose and ground-dwelling insectivores, and they're a prized source of protein and fat for people in the area as well. So they scoop these things up by buckets, and they fry them up, and they eat them, and it's a big feast for the people when these termites come out.
I suppose you don't need any oil to fry them in them.
No, you don't, and I'm told that they taste a lot like peanut butter, but I've never tasted them myself.
Peanut butter? I know someone who would love to eat a termite if it tastes like peanut butter. They are an important source of food. Now, a lot of the focus on the festival has been on the endangered state of some of the insects. Is termite one of those, would you say, Mark?
I'm not entirely sure about termites. They don't occur.
Professor?
I don't think they're endangered at all. What is a little bit tricky is how we relate to them as natural parts of the ecosystem. I work down in the southern African country of Namibia, and one of the things that the local farmers often do is they come up to me and they ask me how to kill their termites because this is a ranching country. They graze cattle, and termites also eat grass, and so the farmers look upon those as competitors for their stock. But what I try to tell them is that no, you don't want to kill them. You know, the fertility that they induce in the soils is part of the reason why you're able to graze cattle in the first place. But you still get lots of farmers that don't get the message, and when they come in and they kill all the big mound-building termites, they open the door for another species, a much more destructive termite that actually can impact on the availability of grazing for their stock. So they're not so much endangered. They're quite abundant. It's been estimated that there's about 100 kilograms of termites for every man, woman, and child on Earth. So there's certainly a lot of them. But the question is whether we relate to them as they should be related to, namely as natural parts of a good productive ecosystem, or whether we think of them just as pests to be destroyed. And the latter part would be a big mistake, I think.
So you're saying it's kind of educational problem that human beings have themselves, especially people who are dealing with termites every day, like farmers.
I think so.
So we should be running an education program for farmers. Maybe we could get them a course at UCL, Mark.
maybe. It'd be a long way for them to travel to learn about, I guess you'd call it termite management, or perhaps psychology courses in, you know, how to get over this bad reputation that they've got, perhaps.
Why is it? We were discussing that this morning, actually, in the talkie-okie. Why is it that human beings have this kind of inbuilt fear of insects? A lot of nightmares, horror films, even some poetry has been given over to the fear of insects.
It's a really strange phenomenon, and we do have people who come up to the Grant Museum throughout the year as a first stage of confronting their fear. So we have lots of things like butterflies, moths, spiders, scorpions in jars or dry specimens. And so they come up to the museum, and at first we kind of have them looking at them from a distance, and then maybe later on handling them. And it could be for a number of different reasons. A lot of people who come to us have a specific event that occurred when they were younger, which means that they become afraid. So I have a friend who's, unfortunately for him, afraid of butterflies because he was stung by a bee when he was younger, but it was a butterfly that he saw, and so he made that association. But what's really weird is he's not afraid of moths, but he is afraid of butterflies, and there's technically no real difference between the two.
That's almost like a curse from a Greek myth. What do you say?
It is. It can be quite debilitating to have these phobias. But I'm not entirely sure why. It just seems to be restricted mostly to insects and other creepy crawlies.
Well, would you agree with me that children, if they haven't been told otherwise, are actually very open to holding and playing with insects? I mean, I used to teach in the Himalayas, and we used to have this light on underneath our window at night that would stay on very brightly. And in the morning, I would open the curtains, and there'd be a line of young boys who'd got up before the alarm in their Wellington boots with cicadas in their eyes, you know, hungry to get anything they could, keep it in their pocket. And they weren't frightened of them at all. I think if we had taught them, you know, ooh, look at it, yuck, yuck, kill it, get it out, they would have adopted that attitude. But at children, they're just much more open to it. So it's perhaps a learned thing.
It might be. Also, it's very bizarre where we are in the world that people are afraid of these animals, because we're very fortunate in that we don't have any particularly nasty or venomous spiders or insects. So it seems particularly bizarre that we do have these fears of them when we don't particularly have any nasty ones. And in places where people do have lots of insects all the time, they don't seem to be half as afraid as these things.
So it's kind of fear of the unknown and unfamiliar. Would you agree, Professor?
Yes, that's part of it. But in our experience dealing with kids and termites, we often bring kids from the local schools where we work in Namibia out to our site to show them what's going on. And of course, there have been a lot of children here. And we found that that children are very, very open and fascinated by this sort of thing. You know, our experience in Africa has been that to the kids there, the mounds are just these big piles of dirt. But when you open them up and show them what's inside, there's just this inherent fascination that comes out. And We've seen something like that in the termite cube pavilion out here. The kids get in there and they just kind of cling to the walls of this thing as if they're insects themselves. And so there's a certain fascination with this. And of course the boys, they kind of like the inherent creep factor, if you will, of these things. And they take to these things very avidly.
So there are actually termites in the pavilion.
There are no termites in the pavilion, but there are kids that act like they want to be termites.
That's brilliant. So it's a kind of inspiring creative spot as well. It's aesthetically very beautiful to see. So it's imitating the undulating walls of the actual termite nest.
That's right.
How hard was it to build it? I heard something about a 3D printer.
Well, this collaboration with Rupert Soar on the biology side, and I've been working out how structure relates to function and those sorts of things. Rupert Soar is involved in an interesting new kind of manufacturing method that does 3D printing of complex structures. And if we're going to apply what we've learned about how termite mounds work to the way that ordinary buildings can capture wind to do things like power air conditioning or ventilation, we need to be able to build very, very complex structures that mimic what goes on inside termite mounds. And so we've had this knowledge now, and now the ability to apply it to buildings requires reproducing these very complex 3D structures. And that's what 3D printing will enable us to finally do. So we're on the cusp of, I think, some very interesting new applications of how to capture wind in ordinary buildings.
Have you heard of 3D printing, Mark?
We do have a lot of experience with that up at UCL, working with other various departments, but I've never quite seen a sculpture quite on the scale of the sculpture we have here outside.
Well, when someone says 3D printing to me, in my mind there's actually a physical printer that's churning out blocks of something.
That's precisely right, except they're blocks of very complex shapes.
What are they actually made of? What's the material that's printing?
They can be made of anything. You can use these 3D printers to lay down 3D structures made of resin or powdered plastic that you then melt, or metal powders that you can then melt into relatively solid metal structures.
You're adding liquid in the printer to the material.
Yeah, it works a lot like an inkjet printer does. Whereas an inkjet printer can lay out complex patterns on a flat sheet of paper, a 3D printer uses the same technology, but instead of advancing the paper underneath the printhead, it lowers it so that you build up layer after layer after layer of shapes, and eventually you end up with this 3D structure made either of metal or resin or plastic.
Fascinating. It's from the future.
Yeah, these kind of techniques are allowing the kind of structures that we just weren't possible before. So it's very, very interesting, and it's come at such a great time, as Professor was saying, about harnessing these natural powers to be saving a lot of energy and a lot of waste. So for the technology to come at a time that we need it, it's going to be some really, really interesting developments, I hope.
It is, and there's so much to be learnt down here at the festival this weekend. We've all learnt something. Mark, what did you learn this weekend?
My faith in the younger generations was restored a little bit.
Been damaged.
Well, I guess, yeah.
Is that from reading the news or
experience? Generally from the media.
They've got so much to answer for, haven't they, the
media?
Yeah,
I know. They're responsible for all things from, the MP's expenses through to climate change, through to all these things. But we've met some fantastic younger people this weekend. There's been some real geeks who will be, who will be replacing us in the future. And there have also been some people who are just absolutely fascinated, but don't get a chance to see these things. So hopefully we've inspired a lot of people to go rooting around in parks and gardens when they get back to see what's there, what's been there all the time, but what they didn't necessarily know was there.
Well, I'd like to see them pulling up the slabs of cement, actually, and encouraging life to grow where there was before some parking spot.
Although there is stuff already growing there, so if you ever see land that's been left or kind of derelict, then very, very quickly you start to see plants and other animals take it over.
Perfectly timed, because talking of derelict land, there's somebody here at the festival this weekend who's installed a mobile brownfield site, which is actually a part of Rescued the Olympic Development. Rob and Roberta Smith, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Yes, it's a mobile brownfield site, and you can come and see it, or you probably just missed it if you're listening to this broadcast, but it's all soil from around the Olympic site. And I was thinking, basically, because I live in Leytonstone, I think when they're building the Olympics, obviously they have got plans for kind of green gardens and all that sort of thing when it's actually on, but the process of making it over the 4 years is obviously very destructive to the ecology of the area. So basically I wanted to, I was sort of inspired by that process really, to make this mobile brownfield site and think actually they're very beautiful spaces, brownfield sites, because they produce plants which produce lots of flowers because the soil is so denuded of nutrients. And so they're very good for pollinating species and insects. And also they're totally ungardened spaces as well. So for years, perhaps decades, people are not tilling the soil or cutting things back. And it just provides an environment for insects, which I think is, you know, interesting.
That's true. As we were just talking, Mark was just telling us about what he'd learned this weekend. And one thing he was saying was that people would go away and feel inspired to do something, you know, and find out something about insects. And I said, I hope they'd pull up some of the cement in their gardens and surrounding areas and let it grow. And he was saying that actually underneath these slabs are many things that, as you explained, have been undisturbed for ages. So that's maybe important. Perhaps we should call for the preservation of large cemented spaces or not. What do you think, Mark?
It's very tricky. But I think without us maintaining or cleaning these things, then they're very quickly reclaimed by nature anyway. So yeah, so perhaps if we lifted up a couple of paving slabs here and there to help them have a head start, then that might be a good thing.
Well, this is the age-old illusion, isn't it, that nature needs us. Actually, nature doesn't need us at all. We need nature. And if we were gone, as is supposedly quoted by Einstein, nature would flourish.
That's certainly true. We're very arrogant sometimes in thinking that, you know, if we were gone, that would be it. But within a very short space of time, there'd be hardly any evidence left that we were here.
Well, Bob, being an artist, Bob and Roberta Smith envisioned some of what might happen if we disappeared, and he's brought along a moss-covered bike, Bob and Roberta. Do I call you Bob or Bob and Roberta?
Bob. the moth-covered bike is actually...
It's moss.
Moss. It's moss, but no, it's originally, it's meant to be for moths, actually, because I work with this lady, a student of mine at London Metropolitan University, Louise Sayera. And I asked Louise to design a bicycle mobile brownfield site. So she worked with the children that she works on in a kind of, she works for this group, I can't remember the name of it actually, but they're a kind of guerrilla gardening group. And she worked with young people and adults to produce this mobile, this bicycle version of it. And the bicycle is absolutely wonderful. Yeah, she's covered it in felt and has been covering it in milk every day. To encourage moths to grow on it, which apparently they do. But then she's also got moss on it. And then it became a bit of a news story because it was stolen from outside her flat. And she for this exhibition, she's had to make another one very quickly. And so I think it's a bit denuded of its moth inhabitants. It's actually a very beautiful thing, the bicycle.
I was going to say it looks beautiful. It kind of has that feel of decaying, you know, what human beings have done with all their industry and everything being reclaimed by nature, which I like very much. Professor, you should perhaps talk to Bob's student, because you've said you worked in Africa with children and showing them termite mounds.
Yeah, we bring students from local schools out to visit us and show them what's going on and try to inspire a love of science and a love of nature amongst those people. And it's been mostly informal. There's been nothing really formal or programmatic, but it's just something we enjoy doing, you know, getting kids out there, because they show this just amazing enthusiasm when you open up a termite mound.
I think you could do with Bob for a couple of weeks for residency, because art is the best way to get children into, I mean, apart from actually getting their hands on, art is a wonderful way to engage children and to get them thinking. Would you like to go to New York, Bob?
I don't want to fly there, no, actually. I've just signed the 10-10 pledge to cut down your emissions by 10% in 2010, which The Guardian are running. So I would like to go to New York. And my wife is actually from New York. So it's a bit problematic in our household at the moment, because I've just said I'm not going to fly anywhere for the next couple of years. And she said, well, you know, we've got to take the kids to see their grandparents.
On the bike.
But it does sound wonderful what you're doing. Yeah?
Thank you.
I think the secret is offsetting, isn't it? If you want to fly somewhere, you can think of a massive way to offset your fuel emissions. For example, I worked in a college. I was forced to go to Florida by my boyfriend's family. And I was feeling really guilty. It was kind of persuaded and cajoled more than forced. And I just watched the Al Gore documentary, so I was really in the wrong mind to be booking a flight to Florida. But the college where I worked had no recycling facilities, and they produced a massive amount of paper. So I kind of alleviated my guilt by getting them to talk to the council about recycling. Have you ever done any offsetting, Professor?
No, I haven't. I'm probably in the minority here, but I think markets and those kinds of mechanisms are going to be leading us towards the green future. And the things that we're doing with termite mounds are, I think, an example of that. You know, if you can learn from them how to power things like air conditioning and wind ventilation of buildings without using a millivolt of electricity, then that is going to have an enormous impact on our use of fossil fuels and emissions of carbon dioxide worldwide. So, and that's a market-driven system.
That's true, and certainly in England we don't have much use for air conditioning, but I imagine in America you do.
Yeah, we do.
And if you go to visit India or, you know, in the Middle East, you can see there's a lot of historic buildings that have got really sensible ways of using natural air, as you say, air channeling. I also saw in India they had a room where pipes were taken from one wall to another with holes in, and they would have silk hanging in the doorway, and they would feed water through the pipes and it would drip down on the silk and the wind would make it very cool. So that's one way where you can sensibly use natural air conditioning. What do you think, Bob?
I think that's right, Fari. No, I think it's funny actually saying that. The Tate very involved in this 10-10 emission thing, and they're proposing a new extension, which is going to be kind of trying to, you know, explore the vanguard of architectural thinking about uses of energy. And actually, weirdly, the building itself does look like a kind of modernist termite mound. It starts at the bottom as a kind of cone, and then goes up I don't know the specifics of the architecture of it, but it does, I think there's something to do with ventilation and shifting air through the building, which is to do with the shape of the building. But it's probably a coincidence that it looks like a termite mound, but it's going to be an interesting project nonetheless.
Well, the professor works with a 3D printer, which you can put powdered metal in and put some water in, and it will actually print a sort of model of a building from the bottom up. So perhaps we could get one of that of the Tate. I'm sure they'd love it. Where is your 3D printer, by the way? Has UCL got one?
We have some small scale ones, but not they wouldn't be able to print off the sculpture that we've got here.
3D printers are actually commercially available. My colleague Rupert Sohr has built one up in Loughborough University for some of the things that we're doing, but the 3D printing industry is to the point now where you can have actual desktop 3D printers, and this is showing up in things like dentist offices. So if you need a crown on your tooth, the dentist can print up a new temporary crown for you right on the spot.
That's amazing. Is it expensive?
Yes, very expensive, but the way these things go right now, the hope is in 10 years you'll have 3D printers in your house, just like you have a computer and a printer. And if you want a new kitchen appliance, you can just buy the license to print it, and then you print it out right there in your kitchen top.
Ooh, sounds scary. Patents and all.
Yes.
I mean, I can imagine if they patented saucepans in 3D printing and there was no more manufacture.
That would be scary.
It would be scary. That's the whole thing about control. And I think you've had a lot more problem with it in America than we have here in England. Yeah. How did you feel when you heard about Indian farmers immolating themselves because of seed patenting?
I actually don't know that controversy. I think that if you want to talk about seeds, there are various ways to improving agricultural productivity. In the past, we've been doing this through selective breeding of certain stocks, and genetic engineering is one way of doing that, but faster and in a more targeted way. Whether this is a good thing or not, I think is going to be determined by market forces and whether there's a market for purchasing those crops.
Talking about genetics, we've been talking about bees this morning. And partially, this collapsing of the hives and everything, that's been blamed on genetically modified crops. Does anyone know or have an opinion on that, the three of you?
Well, don't ask the artist, ask the scientist.
A lot of people call me and ask me about that back in Syracuse. And the actual cause of colony collapse disorder is still a bit of a mystery. It's known that there is a virus involved, and that virus is transmitted by a particular kind of mite. The specific name of that mite, appropriately enough, is Varroa destructor. And
what is it? Can you say again?
It's a mite that carries a virus that infects the bees. And agricultural scientists have zeroed in on some connection with this virus and the mite to cause colony collapse disorder, and the name of the mite is Varroa destructor.
Varroa destructor.
Yeah, that's right. Varroa is the genus, and destructor is the species name. And so those that disease causing organism is somehow involved. What's unknown right now is the extent to which various kinds of hygiene practices by beekeepers and transport of hives across long distances and the stress involved to colonies, to what extent that contributes to those particular disease-causing organisms causing colony collapse disorder. But I doubt that it's genetically modified foods.
There might be lots of contributing factors. It does sound very, very unnatural to be sort of carting hives of bees along to do different jobs in different places. What do you think, Mark?
Well, this is the problem we have with almost all of the kind of farming practices that we have is we realize there are problems, and when there are things like new viruses or new pests, almost as we're identifying them, they've managed to spread to the other end of the world, because we are so connected and the communication and travel routes, it's much, much easier to get from one side of the world to the other. But this also means that these problems aren't as simple as the problems we used to have, because there's so many complex factors involved.
Well, I sort of hesitate to think about market solutions and scientific solutions for lots of the problems that we face. In a weird way, I don't want to sound like a complete Luddite, but a lot of the problems that we face are to do with modes of thinking which were developed to do with modernism in the 20th century, really. And farming is of itself, that is the dawn of civilization. You know, the civilization is born out of farming. So we've been farming for a long time, and we've only been farming with insecticide in the 20th century. So I'm sort of hesitant to think about certainly the market as well, and GM solutions to world hunger and all of that. I just sort of don't really believe in it.
Mark, what's your opinion?
The most sort of parsimonious solution would be for us to try and not be so greedy in some parts of the world. But of course, no politician would be voted in, when things they're telling you are to, make personal sacrifices. So the whole time we're trying to push the technology, or we're trying to push the science to, either more food production or getting more out of the environment, rather than solutions that fix the main cause, in that there's an awful, awful lot of people and we have high, high demands on the environment, and especially in places where we live in excess, basically. It's way, way too, if you go to your supermarkets, just way, way too much, and we are very, very greedy.
It's not just the amount of food we're buying, it's also the packaging that we're taking and the way we're getting them imported out of season, and the way we can't sort of edit ourselves in a way to say, to eat local seasonal vegetables, for example.
Well, yeah, well, this is it, and we touched on it a little bit earlier with personal sacrifices and green solutions to things. Now when we talk about things like recycling and reusing, it's still very much kind of a voluntary thing, or something that you'd like to do to feel a little bit better about yourself. But our children and our children's children, they're not going to have that option. They're going to live in a world where you have to do these things, or there'll be penalties for not doing it, and it just won't be allowed to continue. So we're kind of, we're still in this quite luxurious position where it is all still optional. So there are parts of the country where, recycling isn't a thing that's done, or isn't done by your council. So
I certainly think that, civilization, we live in a world constructed within certain kind of rules, and in a way I think we have to embrace that world, and I'd be quite happy to bring in legislation to fine people if they haven't got a brick in their toilet, rather than encourage people to put a brick in their toilet, you know what I mean? So I think the congestion charge, the anti-smoking laws, they really show the way forward. And so what we need is really brutal, compulsive legislation to, we don't need 4x4s. We don't need cars in London. It's simple, actually, in a way, to save the planet. All we need is the transport system of Freiburg and the energy generation of Denmark. and we can cut Britain's emissions tomorrow. Governments don't want to do that because it's an unpalatable situation.
Yeah, but, it's unpopular.
But I think the way forward is with things like 10-10, the recycling movement, all of that is actually, it's a bit of a windmill, you know, constructed to get people to, you know, to get people along behind a cause, but actually it does make a political movement. And I think as things go forward, the green issues, all of these kinds of issues can become much more political, which is good because then it means that politicians will have to address them. But we need politicians with vision. I mean, Boris Johnson in London is an absolute disgrace. He cancelled the Cross River tram, which was that was the beginning of a kind of 6 years of development of that under Ken Livingstone's. And there are all sorts of other things that he's done which haven't been very good for the environment. And he is a visionless man. He's a nice, seems like a nice chap that you'd like to meet down the pub, but he absolutely has no idea about how to push things forward in London.
Well, this is the thing about capitalism. It doesn't really have a future vision. It's all about now. What can I get now? And not really about what can I lay down for the future. Professor, do you think that, coming from America, you know, we've got things like the smoking ban in public places. We've got things like congestion charge in our central city centres. And we've got councils enforcing, although Mark said it's not all over the country, many councils enforce recycling. How do you think we compare to America?
Well, I can't really speak to the British situation, but because I am American and I'm not from this country. But markets have been knocked around a little bit here, and I will actually defend markets and capitalism as a very natural way to arrive at these kinds of solutions. And just bringing it back to a personal example, you know, we're trying to initiate a very different way of exploiting wind energy. You know, right now, the only ways that you can exploit wind energy effectively is to build a big turbine to turn wind into electricity, or to build a tall building that can capture a particular feature of the wind environment. And both of those are very heavily capitalized. The resources are very tied into large energy companies, and it will come as no surprise that at least in America, those kinds of industries are very, very heavily subsidized by government taxpayer subsidies. And the major effect of those things has been not only to entrench economic and political power in the people and corporations who have patents on these kinds of things, but it also keeps prices up so that spreading wind technology to the ordinary people, to ordinary houses, is very, very difficult. My own feeling is that markets will actually open up a kind of a vast niche for the kinds of wind solutions that Rupert Soar and I are proposing, and the major obstacles that we're facing right now are government subsidies of established and I have to say entrenched ways of thinking about wind power. So I'm very much a believer in free markets. I'm very much of a libertarian bent. I personally don't smoke, and I don't care to be around smokers, but I personally am troubled by a government that comes in and tells people you cannot smoke.
Well, it's interesting to hear your opinion. You know, it's great to have all these different dynamics. So, people listening, if you want to find out more about what the professor's saying, you can go to freeform.org, is it?
It would be better to go to just do a Google search on my name, J. Scott Turner, and I will come up probably at the top of the list. So.
J. Scott with two T's.
Yes.
And if you want to hear more about Bob and Roberta Smith's kind of opinions and all his antics with arts, landfill, moss and bikes, where should people go?
Just stick Bob and Roberta Smith into Google.
Thank you. And Mark, UCL, what, with your department, can we find out more about that?
Yeah, you can come along to the museum. So we're up at UCL near Euston. We're open from weekdays 1 till 5. You can find us on the net from www.ucl.ac.uk.
Where's the entrance? Because I went to UCL, I never saw it.
Well, the entrance is a non-static entity that moves around very often. So you have to get...
It's Mr. Ben's wardrobe,
yeah,
isn't it?
So go to Gower Street. That's where it is most of the time. And if not, then grab someone nearby and they'll be able to point you in the way.
Okay, and Pestival is going on this evening. We've got on this stage the Resonance FM Radio Orchestra. We've got Chris Watson in the Queen Elizabeth Hall. We've got so many things happening with the resident artist Noboru Tsubaki. And so if you've still got time and you're hearing this, come down. And if not, go to pestival.org to find out what the legacy of the festival is going to be. Thanks all for listening, and thanks to my guests.
Thank you.
Bradley.
Goodbye.
On Resonance FM.